Professor Jane's show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieKesserJane.com. Thanks for joining me. I am Hallie Kesser Jane. Today on the Hallie Kesser Jane show, we salute the godfather of soul, the one, the only, James Brown, with my guest, James Brown's daughter, Deanna Brown Thomas, R.J. Smith, author of the definitive James Brown biography, The One, and Jason Emmons, the director of curatorial affairs at EMP Museum. But first, a word from one of our sponsors.
Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org.
He was as soulful as he was soul-filled. He became the godfather of soul. James Brown was born James Joe Brown, Jr. on May 3, 1933, in a one-room shack in the woods of Barnwell, South Carolina, a few miles east of the Georgia border. Legend says he was stillborn and miraculously came to life. His parents split when he was very young, and at the age of four, Brown was sent to Augusta, Georgia, to live with his Aunt Honey, the madam of a brothel. His humble beginnings didn't stop James Brown from becoming a social and cultural force, an American icon whose legacy we may just be beginning to define. Let me bring in my first guest, the man who has written the definitive biography of James Brown, R.J. Smith, the book, The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. A little background on R.J. Smith. R.J. is a Los Angeles-based writer. His first book, The Great Black Way, Los Angeles in the 1940s and the Last African-American Renaissance, won a California Book Award in 2006. A graduate of the University of Michigan, Smith has been an editor at Los Angeles Magazine and LA Weekly, a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, the LA Times Magazine, GQ, Spin, Blender, and more. Welcome to the Hallie Kesser Jane Show, R.J. Smith. Hi there, R.J.
Good God, it's good to be with you, Hallie.
First, R.J., this really is a heck of a book. I understand why it has received the accolades that it has. I mean, if people think that they know James Brown or his music, they haven't a clue until they read The One. But I have
well,
to
that's
ask
really...
you...
What? Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
I was going to say, why
were...
James Brown? That's really my first question. Of all the people that you could have written about in this unbelievable cultural hemisphere that we live in, why James Brown?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I can't think of anybody that I would rather spend time just wrapping my brain around than this amazing, incredible, barely understandable great American artist. I mean, he is deep and complicated, and, you know, I think everyone who thinks about, writes about, and from what I understand, everybody practically who met James Brown came away with a different perspective, a unique story, a unique vision of the person, and I think there are so many stories out there, so many different James Browns out there. I wanted to hear about them all and try to put them all together in one form.
Well, you did do that. You know, I was trying to break down that life of his into cohesive segments, so to say, speak, so we could explore it. But, you know, as the definitive biographer, maybe you can help me with that. Is there a musician, you know, or what else, a personal life, a political activist, a businessman, a showman? I mean, he really was everything,
yeah,
wasn't he?
That's right. He was everything and then some. You know, he was left, right, and center. He was a dancer and a singer and a performer. And if we didn't have ears, he, you know, he would be an amazing visual artist that we'd be talking about today.
No question.
He was desperate and gifted in the art of communication. And, you know, he was complicated and contradictory, a friend of Strom Thurmond's and Richard Nixon's and Hubert Humphrey's and Martin Luther King's. He touched on a lot of bases.
He surely did.
But he was also a father, and among his legacies are his children. I want to bring his daughter, Deanna Brown Thomas, into the discussion. Let me tell you a little bit about Deanna. Deanna Brown Thomas is a humanitarian, entrepreneur, radio and TV personality, actress and writer, and president of the James Brown Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization created according to the wishes of James Brown. Deanna Brown Thomas holds a bachelor's degree from Towson State University and the Columbia School of Broadcasting. She boasts an extensive career as a broadcaster for Clear Channel, Radio 1, and CBS affiliate WRDW. She was program director and on-air personality. She developed an appreciation and understanding of the music industry by watching, working for, and traveling with her dad as executive vice president of James Brown Enterprises. I want to welcome to the Hallie Castor-Jane Show, Deanna Brown Thomas. Hi there, Deanna.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me, Hallie, and hello to everybody. Ow, I feel good.
And having you on the show is making me feel good, too. Well, you certainly knew James Brown as well as anyone, right? Assuming that he was an easy man to know, which I don't know that he was. Do you think you knew him? Do you think you understood what made him tick?
Well, of course, I come from a different background. You know, I didn't have to do any research about him. All I had to do was wake up every morning, and that was my research. I lived it. So, but, you know, I don't think that anyone really could truly understand my father. I think the word that RJ used would barely understand. He had a different relationship with everybody, and it's according, I guess, to the relationship that you had with him, be it you were a daughter, a wife, or an employee or a business partner, whatever the case may be. But my father's life, I do know this, was long, deep, wide. I mean, it goes into the depths of things that that make for a person to be as strong as he was and believe in the things that he believed in. I had to stay up many nights and hear plenty of lectures, you know, and from time to time I can sit back and just be quiet and I can hear his voice saying these things to me as if he was just standing in front of me. And I do that periodically because those are lessons that I won't ever be able to get taught again. And, I mean, there were times my dad would call me at 1, 2, 3 in the morning. He might be in Russia, China, anywhere, and he wanted to talk about his shows. Now, at that time, I didn't want to hear that. I was like, I'm sleepy. You know, he's like, hey, baby girl, what you doing? Oh, daddy, I'm asleep. It's 2 in the morning over here. Oh, that's so good. Let me tell you about the show. And then so you got another hour, 45 minutes. You got to hear this. But I'd give almost anything this day and any day to get those calls again, because the wisdom and the knowledge that my father dropped on me, I'll never be able to read from no book. I'll never be able to learn from no college professor. The best life teaching I had was when I was on the road with him. And I tell
my
dad was a giver. He was a giver. And I don't necessarily mean material things. You know, he gave a lady a car who was doing a prison ministry, and her car broke down. And he bought her a car so she can continue her prison ministry. You know, and he did these kind of things. These are the kind of things didn't get blasted in the news, didn't get written about in all of these great magazines and things. These are the things that he was about. He was a giver, a true giver.
Question for you. He was many things, and you know, as RJ just said, and we'll certainly explore this in more depth in the next hour, but he was a businessman, and his business was music, and he was a writer, and he was a showman, and got into politics, and then there was his family. You grew up in the aura of this larger-than-life thing, and you, by the way, you seem none the worse for wear. I've done a lot of interviews with kids of celebrities and I, right? But having such a complex man as a dad, you know, was he a good father? He must have been for you to have turned out the way
he was.
He
was very strict. I'm probably one that he was, other than my brother Teddy, who died years ago in the 70s, Dad was very hard on me. And any of my brothers and sisters would tell you, oh, my God, he was real hard on Deanna. And I guess he had his reason to be. And I'm glad that he was. Now, during the time he was hard on me, I didn't like it. Like any other child, they don't want to be, you know, and there's some rebellion there. But to this day, I'm so glad he did, because after his death, I mean, it was really hard for our family. We had to go to litigation, and we're still dealing with that. But he prepared me. He literally prepared me and gave me the ammunition that I need today. The things that we're going through today, my father told me about. So it's like when it comes up and things happen, it's like, you know, I have to go back and remember those conversations and what Dad told me. He was strict. He was very strict. He was just as strict as he was at home as he was on his stage. He fined his band members when they hit a wrong note, came with their shoes not shine, uniform not right. He was strict at home. Education was very important. He wasn't allotted a chance to go past seventh grade. He had to go to work because my grandparents were poor, and he had to bring some coins home into the house. You know, no, not the right kind of clothes to go to school and all of that. But when it came time to raise his family, those that wanted to go to school and those that wanted to do something with themselves, yeah, he made sure that happened. And he did that because he taught us. He says, look, they may come try to take everything you have, but they cannot take what's in your mind. They cannot take your education from you. You can get educated, and you can really make something out of yourself, and that's what you need to do.
Let's stop there for a second, because I want to bring that back in. As you'll see, I'm going to take you guys down a road. Come play with me on this.
Jason Emmons, I want to bring you into the show. Jason Emmons is the Director of Curatorial Affairs at EMP Museum in Seattle, Washington, which was founded by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. Opened in June 2000 in an unbelievable building designed by the brilliant architect Fran Gehry, and explores the artists and ideas that fuel popular music and popular culture. Welcome formally to the Hallie Kesser Jane Show, Jason Emmons. Nice to have you here, Jason.
Thank you.
You're certainly a James Brown aficionado. I know you are among the many who feel that he hasn't quite gotten the due in the music world that he deserves. Talk to us about that a little bit. People are late in coming around. Is he getting lost in a mix? What?
Well, I think there's been a resurgence of I think certainly with hip hop, James Brown's role in hip hop has been so huge. But you know, for us as a museum, as we look at it, you know, I think sometimes there's maybe a dozen transformative figures who have changed popular music, who you can really point back to and say, you know, this represents a big shift. And James Brown, you know, probably represents at least two of those, you know, turning R&B into soul and soul music into funk. And, you know, this major shift of moving away from melody and focusing on rhythm. And I think, you know, there's now a number of artists that you see, you know, particularly Janelle Monáe and Bruno Mars, who you can really see the influence of James Brown and are saying, you know, outwardly, hey, this is the guy who really inspired me. And I think when you have young artists like that who are popular, that it sort of draws people back to some of the originators. And certainly James Brown was one of the greatest originators. And so I think when you have artists like that who want to pay respect to those people, they want to pay homage to the past and the people who inspired them, you suddenly get other people interested in it, and there's this resurgence in interest in these people. As there should be.
Which is so important. Yeah, absolutely. RJ, the place, the beginning, in a one-room shack, living in the wilds of, I guess it's Augusta, it's outside in the boonies, the whorehouse, if you will. Take us through his roots just a little bit, because it so affected the sound that became his, right?
Mm. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, at the beginning, there was the blues. His father played some harmonica, sang some blues. James was born, they lived in a little shack out in the country outside of the tiny town of Barnwell. And when he was not even 10, he walked into Augusta with his father and another relative, and really, you know, kind of entered the 20th century then. And this was about 1940 or so. It was, you know, when he was in the woods in South Carolina, it was poor. He would go for days without seeing anybody but his dad. He would play with the bugs under the shack, the June bugs. He called those his friends. You ate what you picked outside of the shack. And then they went to Augusta. And Aunt Honey ran a house of, ill repute, as they say. She sold moonshine. And, you know, James was taking care of himself and those around him. And that meant everything and anything. That meant dancing for coins. That meant racking up balls in billiard parlors, returning bottles for change, getting by any way you could. And that was a lesson that he never unlearned.
And he heard sounds, too, because of the area of the country he was from that later came into play. I don't know. Jason, you want to comment on that or somebody?
Well, and I think, you know, it's interesting that, you know, I think part of that's growing up in isolation when he's an early kid, as RJ was saying. You know, he's growing up, in nature, and there's not much around him. So really listening to the sounds that he's hearing about him, hearing, you know, in nature. And then also, too, I think, you know, a huge influence is when he goes to church, you know, hearing the sounds that he would hear at the United House of Prayer of all people. I mean, rhythm was a really important facet of that church and sanctified rhythm. So with the emphasis on that, I mean, it's not a surprise that rhythm would be such a central part of the James Brown sound.
Hmm.
Jason,
Diana, he was a tough kid.
Oh, I
say that again. I don't think we could hear you, Diana.
I was going to say that I feel like Jason really hit on it in terms of being listening to nature and getting that rawness from nature, and then going into the house of prayer. These are things that he talked about a lot. And one thing about my father is when he voiced it and talked about it a lot, it meant something to him.
Hmm. He was a tough kid, Deanna. Was he a tough down deep?
Was he a tough dad? Yes.
Yeah, well,
yes,
tough, you know, tough is a funny word. I mean, you know, some people are tough on the outside and they're you know, milk toast on the inside. Was he tough inside and out? Do you know what I'm saying,
well,
right?
Well, yeah, I hear what you're saying. He didn't take no chaser, I can tell you that way.
Right.
It was he didn't give up no chaser. It was a straight from the hip. He didn't play around with his words. When he said what he said, he meant what he said. That much I can tell you. But when I say tough, I mean, he was tough on me as a young adult, single mother. He had his reasons, you know, he had his reasons for why he was tough. And he made it was rough for him. I mean, he made me do menial things, simple things. You know, I didn't come up like some of these rich, you know, offspring. I had to go out and I had to water the grass. I got a $3 a week. That was my chore. That's what I had. I had to water the grass, and I got $3 a week for my allowance. So, I mean, he taught me on a basic level. So it wasn't, you wasn't sitting around here, you know, getting all of this stuff and doing all of this. We got to travel with him during the summer when we were out of school and mom would be on the road and all. But no, he brought us up. It wasn't like his, you know, but he didn't bring us up in a way that you just got everything you wanted. He showed you the meaning of going to work for it.
Did he have a sense of humor, anybody? Did anybody know that he had, Deanna, Jay,
yes.
RJ?
Yes.
Yes?
Well, I'm just going to second what Deanna said. Is, yeah, he had a sense of humor. He was a great storyteller, and
yes,
he liked comics, too. He always liked to perform with a comedian in the show.
Okay.
And he would do
I want to tell everybody we're at the 50. Let me just put this in there right now. I want to do a station ID. We are the Hallie Castor Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we are talking to Deanna Brown, Jason Emmons, R.J. Smith, about Mr. James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. Let me take it back to you. Let's go back to the music just for a second. I want to ask you guys about this. On music, how did he get into music, RJ?
Mm. Well, I think one story and one facet of it is he was the kid with the radio glued to his ear. He listened to when he was a teenager and was sent away for stealing clothes to wear out of cars on the streets of Augusta. They called him Music Box because he had the music box to his ear. And he was always listening to gospel and rhythm and blues on the radio. And that's a really important early part of his education. He loved to sing. You know, I think he might have even found out and connected as a dancer even before he became a singer somehow. But he understood quickly in watching preachers, watching gospel singers in various churches in Augusta. He saw the connection they made with listeners, and he decided very early on, I think, that he wanted that connection and that he could have that connection. And so he was singing everywhere. At school, they had daily mini concerts, get-togethers, and they would have the whole school to get together and have James sing the national anthem or sing songs from Louis Jordan and other people to the school to start the school day. He just had it early on.
He just had it. We're going to go to this. I want to ask you this, Jason. The downbeat and the upbeat, which is really where he became so famous. Explain that a little bit to listeners, what that was and what he did differently than everybody else.
Yeah, well, when you think of the downbeat, you know, typical like rock and roll music, the emphasis is on the two and the four. So it's one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. And, you know, he changed that. So the emphasis is on the one. So it's like, bam, two, three, four, bam, two. So, and as he said, you know, as long as you, what he would tell everybody, as long as you knew where the one was, then you could do what you wanted on the rest. You know, you could be playful in there. You could do all these other things within that, as long as you knew where the one was. And, you know, part of the joy of watching him, you know, on YouTube, when you watch him perform, is, you know, he's always making sure that you're there on the one, that everybody's with him. And that was a big shift.
Huge shift. And that takes me two places. RJ, that takes me to the title of your book, The One.
Mm.
Based on that, based on what?
Well, definitely based on that. And based on the way that Mr. Brown made it a whole philosophy of life, I think. He made it this way of being in the world and always being at the center of things, always listening to what was going on around you and always being or always trying to be the master of it, being present in your life. Another thing about the one, you know, it's sort of like the secret sauce. Everybody wanted to know the recipe. James was always talking about it, and he was always creating this ever-growing mythology about it. And people would ask him all the time, what is it? What is it? And he'd go on and he'd talk about it without ever really saying what it was to him. And that was part of it, too, was it was the mystique. It was the mystery of the man. And it was something he wasn't going to tell you. You had to listen to the music to get it.
Fascinating. If you listen to his early sound, it's so mellow compared to where he got, which I guess part of that was the times, too, because you know, the bands that were in or the groups that were in those days did different kind of music. But you know what, Deanna, I love to listen to his older stuff. I love to listen to his ballads. They even though the rest was what got him so famous, when you go back, you really get into who he is when you hear him sing those ballad songs. Do you agree?
Yes. He could be raw and funky and gritty. But he could also really be smooth, and one of my favorite is not necessarily one that he penned, but I, even to this day, still tear up when he sings, when I hear him sing, If I Rule the World, and it comes from, I think it comes from a place that's pure when he sang it. It's a place that, you know, he was not born into. But one thing for sure, he did leave this world a better place with his music because it touches so many people. And it was to touch on something that RJ said about his mystique-ness. It was just, you know, something that was a mystique about him. If he was here, he would tell you the one came from the one, God. He would give God the praise because I think that he couldn't understand himself that he had what he had. It was only, and he would say this, he says, I don't understand it sometimes. He says, but, you know, it's something that God has given me. And that's what I heard him say so many times, is that he couldn't understand it sometimes. He couldn't understand why he had what he had and he could do what he could do. It was just something that he was felt that it was just given from him directly from God.
I think that's an interesting, another interesting turn on that word one that you so perfectly chose for the title of your book, RJ. Here's another one that I think is interesting. You know, he grew up, he was opposites. At least from what I read in your book and from what I, you know, researched on my own, he was happy, he was sad. He was in control, he was a wild man. Is that, I wrote a book about Jim Morrison and the Doors way back when and worked with them, and that was one of Jim Morrison's unique qualities. I would suspect that a lot of entertainers who get to the top have that yin and yang so well developed. Would you guys agree? I'll throw it out there, let Jason, maybe you want to answer that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because there's one of the brilliant moments in RJ's book is where he talks about Marlon Brando, who is the child of alcoholic parents, and how Marlon Brando, there's this great quote there where he says, "When you are a child who is unwanted or unwelcome and the essence of what you are seems to be unacceptable, you look for an identity that will be acceptable." And, you know, then RJ ties that to James Brown, who has this, you know, rough and tumble childhood. He's, you know, he grows up without a mother who comes into his life later. His father's not around much. And watching other people to understand, how do I fit in? How do I create an identity, you know, that I feel good about it, but that also that people are going to realize that I'm not just another person. I'm somebody special. I am the one. I mean, when I hear the one, I also think of the chosen one. And that sense that James Brown seemed to have from a very young age of that there's a specialness about me. And with that comes this incredible ambition and drive. So you have that part where it's the drive forward, but also the tenderness of, you know, the hurt of feeling abandoned or not loved enough, so that you have these sides that, you know, appeals both to ballads, but also the harder, funkier sound that he would come with. This wonderful duality, this complexity that makes him so fascinating. I think all those elements are there for different reasons, but I think that thing about Marlon Brando, of him watching people closely to understand who he wanted to become, but also what is it going to make to have people, you know, love him.
Well, I think that's really important that you even that you brought that up, because here's the deal. I mean, he was a showman. That's what he did, probably.
Right.
I mean, he was lucky he had all the talent with the voice and the dancing and the carrot. But he was like a Liberace of you know, funk, if you will. He knew how to play the room. He knew how to create the character. Was there anybody who did better PR for himself than James Brown? Not many. Would you all agree?
Oh, no. Definitely. I can't imagine.
He was one who could self-promote better than anybody. And if there was one thing definitely in about the business that I learned, is self-promotion. You can't have someone promote you. You got to promote yourself in the light and how you want to be promoted. All those names that people call him came from him, the Godfather of Soul, Mr. Dynamite, Mr. Please, Please. You know, he came up with his names. He didn't let no one else name him. He made his mark.
I think that's pretty important to say, because I think that just is a zillionth of an ounce of the talent that was his, and that's why he's a D all the above kind of entertainer, and those are the guys who probably get to the top. I want to go back before we go to the break, and I want to talk about the times, because I think this is essential also to understand what exactly it was this man accomplished in a very rough time for young black men. It's pre, you know, the 60s, if you will. It's racism is rampant. He's a Southern boy. He's going on the Chitlin' Circuit. I thought, J.R., maybe you, R.J., you wanted, I'm going to call you J.R. now. I wanted to tell you, talk about the Chitlin' Circuit. Talk about how tough it was for a black man to become who he became pre the 60s.
Well, that thing that we call the Chitlin' Circuit, it was, you know, it was a product of segregation, because audiences could not mix under many circumstances in clubs, and because it was complicated and often dangerous for an African-American act just to roll into town on their bus and be proud and play a show. They had to have a special booker and a special circuit all set up, and, you know, they had to have it all worked out carefully ahead of time. It became a classic instance of, well, separate but unequal. It was, you know, everything from small bars and nightclubs to private homes to living rooms to tobacco, house warehouses to outdoor drive-in movie theaters became concert places. It was wherever you could put on a show and then book the next guy the next week. And it was typically in the South, below the Mason-Dixon line. And it was great black showmen and showwomen playing to African-American audiences and forging an amazing special bond that was very much like, I imagine, what one saw then and certainly today in the church. And it was a tough crowd. It was a crowd that was spending, you know, the money they'd saved up all week at work to be entertained on a Friday night. And if you weren't hitting it, or if you didn't do the same thing as well as you did it last time you rolled through town, you know, they didn't just boo you. They might be waiting for you at the bus after the show. So you had to really give it your all and just forget about tomorrow. And then at the end of the night, you got on the bus and went to the next town and did it again.
And let's bring up the point, too, that he couldn't always go through the front door where he was performing. He had to go through the back door. He couldn't eat with everybody else. He had to go to different places. I think there's a thing in your book about him going to like Trailways or something like that because he knew he could get a meal there. I mean, I want to put this in perspective because I think today we take a lot for granted, but at that time it wasn't such a wonderful thing. Deanna, before we go to break, let me ask you this. What do you think is the most misunderstood thing about your father?
Wow.
Tough one?
You know, yeah, you put one on there because I think that, you know, a lot of people didn't understand. You know, they hear about the humble beginnings that he came from, but Dad didn't forget about him. He didn't, you know, get so big till he had to come out and go to L.A. and get a big house. I mean, he lived in New York because that's where I was born. But once he married my mom talked about, you know, living down south and raising children. So we came back down south to Augusta, Georgia. But, you know, he still never forgot where he came from, and he showed that when he would go, and he didn't mind going into the hood all the way up until the day he died and talk to young kids by himself. He didn't need bodyguards. Thus, he did the annual turkey giveaway, annual James Brown turkey giveaway and toy giveaway. He didn't ask corporate sponsors to come and spend money. He spent his own money. You know, that was the difference between my dad and a lot of artists that will put their name on something big as a give back, and it looks good because their name is on there and it looks so they're giving back and they come get the photo ops and all of that. No, my dad did it. He bought the turkeys. He bought the toys. Now, if people wanted to come and wanted to donate towards it, he didn't mind that. But he didn't play up to the hype. As a matter of fact, his whole thing was don't believe the hype. He didn't play up to it. He did things and he kept it real because he didn't forget where he came from.
Interesting man for sure. We'll be exploring more of Mr. James Brown, the Godfather of Soul, after we take a brief break. So sit back and relax while we take care of some business. You were listening to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is always available online at HallieKasserJane.com. Today, the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. And we are back on The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds. Nice to have all of you here with us today. Today we are focusing on the life of the Godfather of Soul, James Brown. With me today, his daughter, Deanna Brown Thomas, president of the James Brown Family Children Foundation, a nonprofit organization. R.J. Smith, the author of the definitive biography of James Brown, The One, and the director of curatorial affairs at EMP Museum, Jason Emmons.
So I want to ask you, Jason, tell us a little bit, what is funk for those who don't know? Brown helped turn soul into funk, didn't he? And he is the grandfather of hip hop. So we might as well go there, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, funk, you know, you could describe it as a mixture of soul music, jazz and R&B. And really what it's doing is it's de-emphasizing melody and harmony and really emphasizing, you know, the rhythmic groove of the electric bass and the drum. So those get pulled to the foreground. And often it can just be a, you know, one chord vamping that's happened and this emphasis on rhythm. So really, you know, the idea is to get people moving. And, you know, almost nobody was better than that than James Brown. But, you know, one of the things I loved about it that RJ talks about in his book is that any time that James Brown was changing his sound, he would change his drummer. And, you know, this was a key thing. Like, okay, I'm making a shift. I need to get people who can hear what I'm hearing and then communicate it to them and then have them help create this sound.
Interesting. Let's go to style. Well, we touched on a little bit, but tell us about the people who most influence his sound and style. And I guess, RJ, you want to start with that, and maybe, Deanna, you'll come in after on that subject. I mean, I know there was Little Richard, for sure, but there were the others, and we touched on them briefly, Black Boxer, Bo Jack, and Sweet Daddy Grace, and United House of Prayer. So talk to us about that, because sure. I do think that that's so much of who he became.
Yeah, well, Bo Jack was a great little-known today boxer from Augusta who predated James by just a few years. And, you know, very much, you know, the story is that he was shining shoes on a street corner in downtown Augusta. And, you know, competitors would try to take his corner away from him. And that's when Bo Jack discovered what a good boxer he was. And, you know, the story goes that after he became a boxer and the world started to know him, James Brown had that corner for a while. So there's a continuity that way. There's also a continuity in the way that Bo Jack was the classic never-say-die boxer. One time in a famous match in Madison Square Garden, he hit his foot caught on something on the floor, and it ripped his knee. He had I don't know if he broke his knee or tore a muscle, and he kept boxing kind of on one leg for the rest of the match. He wasn't going to give up ever, and certainly that's something that James Brown was paying attention to. You know, as far as the man known as Sweet Daddy Grace, yeah, I mean, he was he's a really amazing American that we should know more about than we do. United House of Prayer, his church, put the drum at the center of the music in church in a way that was very fresh and original and very important to American popular music of all kinds. He was a salesman, I would say, along with being a man of God, or he wouldn't make that distinction. He saw the two as being all part of the same thing, and certainly there's the prosperity gospel, that's a part of what he was about. The idea of being all business all the time, that certainly had an impact on James Brown. You know, everything, the drums, controlling audiences, all of that James Brown was paying attention to. As far as musicians, well, early on, I can't think of anybody more important than Louis Jordan and his band, the Timpani Five, the great jump band, where they, you know, was kind of taking swing music, swing jazz, to a smaller band sound. They were playing that Chitlin circuit. They were playing the black theaters like the Apollo and the Howard, the Lincoln in Los Angeles. They were playing every night, and they had the world's best rhythm section. It was as smooth and as tight as, you know, just a streetcar on golden rails or something. And he loved him as a singer and as an icon and as a dresser. I think James Brown, there was a time when he wanted to be Louis Jordan as a young man.
Yeah, I think I did read something about that. Yeah, let's continue on style just for 1 second, because really, he did these bits. Like the bit was on stage with the black cape. I mean, you know, brilliant.
Yeah.
So explain that. Somebody pick that up. I mean,
he got that from the boxer, as RJ said, he liked boxing and he watched boxers a lot. And if you remember the boxer, Gorgeous George used to come out with a cape on and everything. So the whole cape thing came from that. That he remembered that as a young kid. That, you know, that impressed upon him. So that's where the whole cape, because at first it started where he used to come out with first he started just with a little briefcase, but then he went into the whole cape action, which became his thing. He's known to have the cape put on. And Mr. Danny Ray, who I call Uncle Danny Ray, is still around, who put the cape on him.
Really? Fascinating.
Yes.
How old is he now?
Uncle Danny actually just turned 78. He just turned 78 in a few months ago.
Wow, amazing. So in that whole thing,
amazing. I would like to add this, Holly, if you don't mind.
Go ahead. Sure, be my guest. You are my guest.
Thank you for having me as your guest. But I listen to all of you, and I listen to what, you know, you talk about in terms of dad and everything and all that he brought to music. You know, I just recently had some of my students go to a Juilliard jazz camp last week, and I told them after it was over with, I said, now I'm going to show you how powerful my father was when it came to the change in music to funk, like you said, Jason. His they went the 2 and 4. I said, so you're going to come over here, you're going to learn the book way. And Dad used to always tell his band members, you know, you can't write this down. It comes straight from the gut. It comes from the soul. So that's why soul music. He's like, you can't write this down. They got the 2 and 4, but we got the 1 and 3. But what's so amazing is that the people who worked behind him, those band members, in my opinion, I mean, I grew up under all of them mostly, and they watched me grow up, but they are the unsung heroes because they're the ones who were in the studio, who did the grueling tours day in and day out and put the music together. I mean, yes, Dad was the genius. He told them what he wanted, and he made it happen. But these people have got stories from Uncle Danny Ray all the way to the youngest band member, Keith Jenkins, who's the maestro for my music school, James Brown Academy of Music Pupils. I mean, and what we're doing now is we are working with the band and booking them for shows and master classes. And these master classes are awesome because here are the people who worked right there with him on the stage, on the road, and they tell these stories of what Dad did when it came down to rehearsals, putting songs together, this, that, and the other. And, I mean, it ranges from, like I said, Uncle Danny, who started in 1960, all the way up to Keith, who started in 1994. And you talk about amazing. That's amazing to get a master class on working for James Brown. I mean, I can't begin to tell you some of these stories that they have. And it just molds into why he was the way he was. Because what Daddy was and what he gave these musicians are still a part of their soul, their whole life. That music, I mean, is so obvious that his music is just is part of the fabric of American life, of life, period.
You are listening to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we are talking today about the one, the only, James Brown. He broke ground, and I think this is also important to his story, because he became pioneering for a black artist and that he took control of his own career. And I think we should talk about that, he wound up owning James Brown and nobody else owned James Brown. RJ, something you want to say about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's a big part of his story. Yeah, he wanted to run things top to bottom, and certainly as Danny was just saying, that's the story of the band. And if you understood the meaning of the word sideman, you could have a great time. But if you wanted to run things yourself, then it got complicated. He wanted to make business history, and he did, running restaurants and hotels, a string of radio stations.
Yeah.
At the same time, it was heartfelt and complicated. He wanted to run all the stations and all the businesses by himself, or largely by himself, and call all the shots. And, you know, I talked to Reverend Sharpton about this, and he talked about watching him get off a plane from one town, you know, heading to the next show, get off a plane, find a payphone back in the day, and then, you know, call all the stations and start telling them this and that and, you know, what they got to do the next week and what songs to play, and then getting back on the plane. And that is an illustration of great control and great vision and energy, and it's a tough business model.
And you know what's so great about that? Because I'm one of those jocks that he did that to. when we owned their station here in Atlanta and Augusta, Georgia, he would do that. He'd be on the road. But the great thing about that, RJ, is that it wasn't just about make sure you play his newest song that he wanted everybody to hear, but he wanted these artists to get airplay. It was so important to Dad for other artists who could not get airplay to get airplay. And I thought that was noble of him, you know, to be concerned about other artists making sure that they get the airplay that they deserve because they got good music. You know, that is just so amazing.
Yes.
But
he built himself as
the... Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out, you know, it's interesting. It was one of the great sources of tension in his life. But, the you know, King Records, which was owned by Sid Nathan, and there was always tension between the two of them that, you know, Sid had this idea of, you know, what James should be putting out. When they heard the first records, they, you know, they hated it. And yet, you know, he was sort of a model in a way, and that Sid Nathan had created an entirely independent record label that could do everything by itself. You know, they could record the record, they could press the record, they could distribute the record. And I think in some ways, even though they were often fighting with one another, that, you know, that had to have been a model for James Brown to see, like, this guy's doing it all by himself. I want to do that. It's also interesting that, you know, one of his biggest selling records, Live at the Apollo, was one that Sid Nathan didn't want to do. And so James Brown said, look, I'll pay for it. And then when he brought the recording back to him, even then Sid Nathan resisted. And it wasn't until James Brown was handing it out to other DJs and they started saying, oh, my God, this is incredible, that it actually got released. And eventually he reaches this point where Sid Nathan says, okay, you know, you're the greatest artist I have. I'll give you complete artistic control. But, you know, he really has to fight to gain that. But you can see, you know, that's what he's looking for. He wants control over his own destiny.
I think that goes back a lot to his youth, too, where his life was so out of control and so in the control of people who weren't doing the best thing for him. I'm always into
right.
psychological
Absolutely.
Ramifications for people's behavior. I want to go to politics now, because it's funny, RJ, because you refer to him in the press stuff as Zelig, that wonderful character who always showed up at the right place at the right time in Woody Allen movie. But he did have some odd friendships. A black man from the South, friendship with Strom Thurmond, oh my gosh. He supported Richard Nixon. At the same time, Martin Luther King, you know, he good friends, Hubert Humphrey, Malcolm X. I mean, he had ideas that were so independent to the moment. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, you can look at, like, 1 year, 1968. In 1968, he released a string of great singles. Two singles in particular that I'm fascinated by. One came out at the beginning of the year, America is My Home. And it was almost a rap ballad. He talks it as much as he sings it. And it's a real love it or leave it kind of song that says, I love it here. And, you know, he's kind of saying, we're fighting overseas and we're taking a lot of grief. And this is our moment. We have to decide which side we're on. Well, that sentiment was something that, you know, somebody like Merle Haggard could have sung and did sing in different contexts. And then later on that year, of course, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. I don't think Merle Haggard would have sung that. I don't think many soul stars would have been brave enough to sing anything like that then. You know, he was contradictory. He saw the big picture. And it's funny how, you know, we one thing we love about a great American artist like Bob Dylan, say, is that they are chameleons and that they don't, their ideas and their politics and their periods of music don't line up neatly in a row. They keep us guessing. And I'm not sure that James Brown has ever gotten that kind of appreciation. I think that if we look at him as a politician, we're missing the picture, because he was an artist with an artist's ideas, even when it came to politics. And they don't line up, and we can argue with them, and we should argue with them, as we should argue with politics in general. But he was similarly a brilliant chameleon that you can't put into any one box. Yes,
I think one of his great... Yeah, I was going to say this. That I think one thing that I discerned about him is that he knew how to use his fame to a positive outcome in the political realm, if you will, to help. And I think that's not always responsibly done by entertainers who get to the top of the heap. So I wanted to add that. You were going to say something, Jason, and I interrupted you. I apologize.
Well, I love you know, the pairing with Dylan, because I really think, you know, both of them understood the importance of mystique. And yet they both, as you say, they're both sort of problematic in a way. And I think Dylan gets cut more slack for it. But Dylan, you know, we have these expectations that, you know, of who he is, that he's going to be this progressive. And when he doesn't act that way, then we're like, why isn't he doing that? And I think the same thing happened with James Brown. You think, oh, well, he's going to completely be aligned with Martin Luther King. And when he's not, why is that? What is he doing? And so I think he's a problematic figure for many people in that way, is because of the complexity of it. And one of the things you have to love about him is that he's so independent that no one's going to tell him, this is how you have to think. It's going to be, no, this is how my view of it, and I'm going to stick with it. And, you know, he's fascinating for that reason.
Deanna, what was his favorite song?
I wanted to say all of you have said some great things about his place in politics, his place in humanity, civil rights. It's a shame that we don't hear songs today that can help further the conscience of people through music. It's like people are some artists are afraid to take a stand. We don't hear those self-conscious musicians coming out with songs anymore with those types of lyrics to help build them up. But I believe that he lived his song, why he could do them and do them with boldness. Don't be a dropout. Well, he had to drop out because of his situation, but he realized that that's not the thing to do. So he encouraged other young kids to don't be a dropout. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door. I get it myself. Okay, you ain't got to give me a handout. Give me a way out, and I'll show you. I'll work my way. I'll get it myself. I don't need it to be given to me. America's my home. That was another one, RJ, that you talked about, because he was very patriotic in his own way, living in America, okay? And that's such precious to me right now because my kids are learning that song right now. But it's one of those things where he lived his songs. So it wasn't that he had a favorite one, Holly, but no. I believe that he wanted to be sure that people understood life as it was for him, but life as it was not just for him, but for other people. He was for the underdog because he was the underdog. So he was a champion for the people. That's why 1968-9 Life magazine could ask the question, Look magazine could ask the question, is this one of the most important men in Black America? Because he had a different, he had a way of coming up. He wasn't polished and educated like Dr. King, okay? He had to come up on the rough side. However, he could use what he had to deal with, put it in his songs to help other people in their pain, in their second pain.
I want to go here. We're all yin and yang. We're all good. We're all bad. We're all funny. We're all sad. At the end of his life, he had a small implosion, to say the least. And I want to talk about that, not in a salacious way, but in this way, that I think that it really tells you who, what a broad spectrum of a human being this guy was, how much his youth and what happened to him then affected him, and how much his celebrity affected him. At the end of the day, Deanna, just did he die a happy man? Did he die a sad man? Did he die both because he was this broad spectrum and that was the way that it would have to end for him?
I believe that there were some things that he wished that he could have corrected or did something about. But we all may die that way. You know, we feel that way now, that there were some things that we wish we could have changed or we wish we could fix, but it may be too late. He mentioned that to me kind of oddly, and I was kind of surprised, you know, about how he just felt about my mom. Just having a father-daughter conversation. And it was just some things that he wished that he had not done. He wished that he had done. But he realized it was too late. So I think that he had a full life. He affected so many people. And I think it amazed him sometimes how he affected people and how he made his impact. Here are people who can't even speak English, but they can feel James Brown through his music. They make a connection with someone that they have no idea what they came from. I can never speak about my dad's poor life because I wasn't born into that. I was born into a privileged life. But he taught me the meaning of helping those who did not have that opportunity because I saw that in him. And that would be what I would say for my father is that the last thing he did was the annual James Brown toy giveaway. That was his last public appearance. It wasn't on a stage. It wasn't in a television show. It was right down on Broad Street in Augusta, Georgia, where he grew up. Helping young people, young Black people and white people that were in that line, give toys to their children when they otherwise could not. That would be my father.
So now you continue the legacy, the James Brown Family Children Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization created at the wishes of your dad. And Champ, tell us a little bit about what you're doing here, and we really only have like 30 seconds, so have fun.
Champ is James Brown Academy of Music Pupils. Dad always talked about music in the schools and how important it was because it changed his life. And when you take music and prayer out of school, you're going to see kids killing one another. He talked about that and drilled that in me, and that's what I am trying to do. I'm not trying to take credit for his dream. I'm just trying to be a soldier on the field to get it done. And it has been blessing me and the children that it has affected. It has been blessing them. I've seen lives changed. He told me that if you put an instrument in a child's hand, you'll see a life change. and I've seen that. So that's what JAMP is all about. We're just blessing some kids right just blocks away from where James Brown had to go to that ill repute house and live in, under those conditions. We're doing it just a few blocks away from where he grew up. And I am a blessed person more than I am, more than I have, more than I was before, because I have my life founded up in these young kids, and it's all about the goodness of James Brown and his music.
Unbelievable organization. We're going to put some information about that up on our website. RJ, I want to ask you, you went into this to write about this man at the end of the day when you were all done and you put that last word down on paper. What were your feelings?
Oh, I'll tell you what. I could have had another five. It took me about 5 years to write this book, and I could have enjoyed my every day for another 5 years working on this book some more. I am fascinated by the man, and I love the music. I think you can never get tired of this music. A lot of music that I love, You get to know it kind of front to back after a while, but that's not true of James Brown music. You can hear it, and you can hear something new and hear it on a deeper level the more you listen to it, and we haven't got to the bottom of it yet.
Jason, I know that you want to try and get an exhibition together, and I'm excited about that. Talk to us a little bit also about what's happening at EMP Museum. Fabulous place.
Yeah, it's, well, for us, I know, I mean, you know, to be able to do a James Brown exhibit would be a dream. I mean, a musical innovator whose legacy is only going to grow greater and greater, and to be able to share that story with, you know, a vast audience would be exciting. We just opened an exhibit from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame called Women Who Rock, Vision, Passion, Power, which explores a 70-year history of women in rock, performers from Bessie Smith up through Lady Gaga, who've had an impact on popular music, and just opened it a couple weeks ago.
And I want to tell everybody that we did do a show on that with Rock Hall a few months ago.
Oh, excellent.
Go. Yeah, it's a great show. You can go there with some celebrities are on that show with us on the website, HallieCasterJane.com, to see what you can find. We began this conversation with my saying that James Brown was as soulful as he was soul-filled. He became the godfather of soul. And as we wrap up the conversation on the legendary godfather of soul, James Brown, I want to read you an excerpt from the New York Times obituary. This really struck me. His music was sweaty and complex, disciplined and wild, lusty and socially conscious. So let me add to that, as was the man who the world lost at the age of 73 on December 25th, 2006. I want to thank three terrific guests. Deanna, you are just wonderful. I am sure your dad is incredibly proud of you wherever he is. And I want to tell everybody that you can get more information about everything that she is doing at the James Brown Family FDN.org website. Thank you, R.J. Smith. His book, The One, The Life and Music of James Brown, a must read. Thank you, Jason Emmons from EMP. And if you are in Seattle, you have to go to this extraordinary museum. That current show is the Rock Hall on Roll Hall of Fame's Woman Who Rock, Vision, Passion, Power, the subject of one of our earlier shows. You could also get that, download that from iTunes under the Hallie Jane Show. But to learn more about the EMP Museum and to see this extraordinary building that sits in the middle of Seattle, www.empmuseum.org. Guys, really, I have to say from the bottom of my heart, I wish we had 4 hours. I would have stayed with you. That's how great I think you all are. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. That's great.
All right.
Thank you.
Talk
it's
to y'all soon.
World, but it wouldn't have a
go ahead, darling. Say it. Say it loud.
Say it's a man's world, but it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or girl. Go, Holly.
Go, Deanna. We'll talk soon. Thanks again, guys. Loved having
okay,
you here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
You.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Go. I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under the Hallie Jane Show. The Hallie Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google the Hallie Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieCasterJane.com. which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieCasterJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Casser Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Casser Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieCasterJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieCasterJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Casser Jane. It's a wrap.